Call this March 23rd meeting to order. You will with me, join me in turning off your cell phones so it doesn't ring during the meeting. We'd like to ask Father Walsh from St. Margaret Mary Catholic Church to come forward and do the invocation, and we'll follow by the Pledge of Allegiance. Father Walsh.
Good afternoon, everybody. So let us bow our heads as we pray. Lord God, as we gather here this afternoon, we take a quiet moment in your presence to thank you for our many blessings and our many gifts. We realize that all that we have and all that we are is your gift to us, even life itself. We're grateful for life, for family, for friends, for community, for city, for all the good things that happen here within our city. We're grateful for our freedom, for our food, for the quality of life that we enjoy here in Winter Park, for the security which is offered to us. Also, Lord, as we gather on this day, we realize that this is a time of transition, the time of new beginnings, the time of changing the guard. And so for what has been accomplished in the past, for our outgoing mayor and for our city council, and for all the good things they have accomplished over the years, we are especially grateful. And as we look toward the future, we pray for our new mayor, Mayor Leary, and also for our new commissioner, Greg Seidel, and indeed for all the commissioners. We pray, Lord, that as the journey into the future, that they may continue to ensure the quality of life we have enjoyed here in our town. And in order for that to happen, we just pray for wisdom, we pray for insight, we pray for vision to know what to do and how to do it in the days and the weeks and in the years ahead. Also, Lord, we pray for courage. Courage to stand up and not be controlled by special interest groups. We pray that what is done within this city may be for the benefit of the entire city family. Also, Lord, I think that we need to always be concerned for struggling people in our midst. And so if there is a bias within the council, we pray that it be toward those who are struggling. And so, Lord, on this day, as we celebrate a new beginning, we ask to journey with us, we ask to watch over us, and as we enjoy the good things that are offered to us here on a daily basis, help us always to be concerned for the needs of our world and for the struggling people in our midst. In Jesus Christ we pray. Amen.
Thank you, Father Walsh. At this time, I'd like to ask Greg Seidel and his wife Valerie to come forward for the oath of office.
Hello? Yes? Yeah. I, Greg Seidel.
I, Greg Seidel.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will support, protect, and defend.
That I will support, protect, and defend.
The Constitution and government of the United States.
Constitution and government of the United States.
And of the state of Florida.
And of the state of Florida.
That I am duly qualified to hold office.
That I am duly qualified to hold office.
Under the Constitution of the state.
Under the Constitution of the state.
And that I will well and faithfully perform.
And that I will well and faithfully perform.
The duties of City Commissioner.
The duties of City Commissioner.
For the City of Winter Park.
For the city of Winter Park.
Of which I am now about to enter.
Of which I am now about to enter.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Soon. You know, I'm the new person up here. This is all new to me, and I'm looking forward to it. This is actually, you know, training by, or baptism by fire. There's been no formal training for the commission, so I'm not going to say much, except I'd really like to thank my supporters and thank everyone here in this city. We have a great city. I look forward to serving this city and look forward to doing great things with everybody. And with that, I'll get over to the next item on the agenda. Thank you, everybody.
Steve Leary to come forward, I believe, with his family, and it's, I think his son William's going to lead you.
I, Steve Leary, do solemnly swear.
I, Steve Leary, do solemnly swear.
That I will support, protect, and defend.
That I will support, protect, and defend.
The Constitution of the Government of the United States and the State of Florida.
The Constitution and Government of the United States and the State of Florida.
That I am duly qualified to hold office under the Constitution of the United States.
That I am duly qualified to hold office under the Constitution of the state.
Yes. And that I will well and faithfully perform the duties of mayor for the city of Winter Park, of which and I am now about to enter.
And I will well and faithfully perform the duties City of Winter Park, of which I am now about to enter.
So help me God!
So help me God.
Great job. Well, first I want to thank Caroline. I am out of the house a lot, and it takes a lot to run the three of you guys. So, Caroline, thank you. A special thank you to Alexandra, Jack, and William. You guys are the reason I do this, so thank you. Thank you to my family, my parents, my in-laws, my brothers came in from out of town to help me with this, which was quite a shock. Thank you to my team who is always there, working hard, keeping everything else running smoothly while I step forward to this volunteer position. Bill, Meg, Paula, Jeff, close to 30 others who work for our companies, I want to thank you guys for everything. I want to thank you to my fellow commission members and city staff. There's no better experience for this position than sitting up there for 4 years working with you all. I'm very proud to call you friends, coworkers, as well as the 500 employees of the city. You make me proud every day, so thank you. A special thank you to Mayor Bradley, who couldn't be here today. We've accomplished so much in this city in the last 6 years, and much of it due to his leadership. The city's a much better place than it was 6 years ago, and Mayor Bradley deserves a lot of that credit. This campaign brought an incredible turnout. We had over 2,700 more ballots cast than were cast last year during last year's election. It's a 67% increase in 1 year. This is as close to as many that voted during a presidential primary. And I think, you know, a lot of this had to do with this being about the future.
Robert Frost wrote that the afternoon knows what the morning never expected. It's the Commission's responsibility to prepare for a generation of afternoons, to prepare the future for our children and our children's children. That's never been as important as it is today. Our region is changing rapidly. We need to work like never before to make sure that we maintain the uniqueness of Winter Park through all this growth. There are certainly both drawbacks and benefits to growth, and we need to make sure we take advantage more of the benefits. We need to make sure that we manage the impact of this changing region on our quality of life. I plan to work with my fellow commission members and city staff to do just that. That means continuing to conservatively manage our finances, continuing to manage our urban forestry management plan, and continuing our efforts to improve our corridors. It also means working with partners to manage development, to manage traffic, and to manage our infrastructure. Mayor Bradley was always fond of saying, we don't live on an island. We cannot do this alone. We'll continue the outreach tomorrow. We head up to Tallahassee to talk to our state leaders to make sure that they know what we're facing and look for their help. And we'll continue to strengthen relationships with our other neighbors. We'll continue also to continue to reach out to our residents and businesses for their input. I want to thank you all for being here. I want to thank you all for your support. I'm looking forward to your support moving forward. This entire commission is, we need it. We need help moving forward. Thank you all very much. And to quote our governor, let's get to work. Thank you all.
This is the point. If you'd like to leave, feel free to head out now when we get our papers straight.
Right. I also want to thank Father Walsh for his invocation. Father, thank you very much. We'll give everybody a couple seconds. Well, we're looking for a motion to approve the agenda.
So moved.
Randy, no changes?
No changes.
Okay, so we'll approve as is.
Second.
Okay, and we will look for acclamation by the commission. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Great. I have mayor's report. I'm going to ask a few people to join me at the podium. Drew Dennison, our Urban Forestry Management Manager. Where is Drew? Is she with us? There you are. And I'll also bring up Sean Gallagher, the Orlando District Manager with Florida Forest Service. Wonderful. We are receiving some very special awards today in recognition of our efforts to preserve and nurture our beautiful city. I'm going to turn over the podium to Sean.
Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor and the commissioners. My name is Sean Gallagher. I'm the Orlando District Manager for the Florida Forest Service. It's a pleasure to be here and present the City of Winter Park with the National Arbor Day Foundation's Tree City USA and Growth Awards for 2014. I'll also be presenting the Tree Line USA Award to Winter Park Utilities. This is the 35th time the City of Winter Park has received the Tree City USA Award, and the 23rd time it has received the Growth Award. It is the first time Winter Park Utilities has received the Tree Line USA Award, which is a relatively new award anyway. The Tree City USA program was started by the National Arbor Day Foundation in 1976 to recognize cities with comprehensive urban forestry programs. To receive the designation of Tree City USA, the community must meet four standards. One, have a tree board or department. Two, have a tree ordinance that protects trees in the urban forest. Three, have a community forestry program with an annual budget of at least $2 per capita. And four, have an Arbor Day observance and proclamation. The Growth Award was created to recognize cities which make a concerted effort to improve and expand their urban forestry programs. It's given to communities that go beyond those four standards I just mentioned and demonstrate improvement and growth of the program. To be eligible for this award, the city must have received the Tree City USA Award at least two consecutive years and spent at least as much on tree care as the prior budget year. The Growth Award recognizes activities that fall into these four categories: education and public relations, partnerships, planning and management, tree planting and maintenance, and also Treeline USA. Finally, the Treeline USA program was created in a partnership with the National Association of State Foresters. It recognizes best practices in public and private arboriculture and has five core standards: quality tree care following industry standards, annual working training, tree planting and public education, tree-based energy conservation programs, and Arbor Day celebration. It is an honor to be here today and present these awards to the mayor and commissioners, urban forestry staff, and residents of Winter Park. Congratulations.
I'm also going to ask our Water Treatment Chief, Gary Heller, and Water and Wastewater Utilities Director, Dave Zuzzi, to join me. We have a great proclamation here. This is for our Water Conservation Month. Incredibly important, especially in the city of Winter Park. This is a proclamation celebrating Water Conservation Month, April 2015. Whereas water is a basic and essential need of every citizen, and whereas clean, safe, and sustainable water resources and supplies are vital to the City of Winter Park economy, environment, and its people, and whereas the State of Florida, Area Water Management Districts, and the City of Winter Park are working together to increase awareness about the importance of the efficient use of water and advocating sound water conservation practices, and whereas the City of Winter Park and the State of Florida have designated April, typically a dry month when water demands are increased, as Water Conservation Month to educate private citizens and other users about efficient use of our precious water resources. And whereas the City of Winter Park has encouraged and supported water conservation through various programs and is committed to setting a good example for its citizens regarding water conservation. And whereas every business, industry, school, and citizen can make a difference when it comes to conserving water. Now therefore, I, Steve Leary, by virtue of the authority vested in me as mayor of the city of Winter Park in the state of Florida, do hereby proclaim April 2015 as Water Conservation Month in the city of Winter Park, and urge all residents and businesses to help protect our precious water resources by practicing water-saving measures and becoming more aware of the need to save water.
Gentlemen, this is for you. Dave, would you like to step to the podium real quick?
Thank you, Mayor. I just got back today, actually, from a water sustainability conference in Portland and heard from many people around the country who are struggling and wrestling with water conservation or water sustainability. It's a huge issue nationally and worldwide. But Winter Park has done a very good job and continues to be very progressive in that area, and they're pleased to have the support of the commission for this month. Thank you.
City Manager's Report.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. First, I want to report we had a successful, a lot of people ride the Sunrail at the Art Festival over the weekend. Give you some numbers that they gave us today. They estimated on Friday that 7,200 riders came to Winter Park via Sunrail. And on Saturday and Sunday combined, 26,000 riders. So it was obviously standing room only, and had to run some extra trains to pick up some people that couldn't get on the train, but they managed it. And that's compared to about 9,500 that rode it that weekend that they did it for the soccer. So that could give you some perspective there. So it's a very, very good event.
Randy, are those official, or are we getting a tighter one?
So those are unofficial, but it's their estimate at this time. So obviously it's kind of rounded there, but credit.
You know, it's a shame that contract prevents us from, I mean, even if you charged $1 a day to ride the whole train, it would have paid for itself.
Yep.
With that number of riders, it would have turned a profit for that.
Right. One of the issues there is that they only have two kiosks per station. You have everybody come, that many people coming at one time. They're not equipped to handle that many people at one time with the kiosk.
But even a buck a day to ride the whole thing for the day or something. Right. Anyways, but it's too bad. But anyways, that just goes to show that I'm glad we did that.
It was a great training exercise for them to see how to handle that large of a crowd, and they rallied to get it done. So
great.
Second, I wanted to get some more conversation going about the visioning steering committee. I've heard from several commissioners with questions about certain things and comments about others. So one is whether we didn't really factor in whether Commissioner Seidel should get two appointments. So wanted to hear from the commission on that issue.
Yes, I think he should.
Yes, support from my as well.
You got three heads. Yes.
Huh?
So hey, you got three.
Got four.
And then
you got sure about that, right?
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Well, can we have commissioner bring that back by the next commission meeting to assign two people?
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. All right. Thank you.
Randy, while we're on the topic of the visioning, do you mind if I...
I think he was going to go further, Commissioner.
I got two more items. Second item was we had a conversation about alternates at that meeting where we did the board. And so the question, my interpretation, one of the commissioner's interpretations was slightly different, so I wanted to get clarification from the commission of whether there was an intention to appoint alternates at this time. The conversation was that There may be a need to appoint alternates in the future, maybe a need to appoint alternates because of the length of this process and, people's schedules, that type of thing. So I wanted to know if you're intending on each commissioner appointing an alternate, and if so, would that alternate just serve to replace the two appointees each of you have, or how would that work?
It was my intent not to appoint alternates. The process like this, you get so involved in it. You're either in or you're out. And I'm just wary of having, we've got 12, you're going to add, 12 more alternates. You've got two more coming on. You're going to have a steering committee that's bigger than an NFL football team. I'm not sure that's really the way I had envisioned it, but that's me.
Well, I went back to the minutes because I actually was one of the people that brought it up, and the minutes are very clear. It says a majority agreed that due to unforeseen time commitments, an alternate person may need to be appointed by each commissioner. And the first meeting, they didn't do a survey to find out.
Yes, we did.
Okay, sorry. The person that I appointed said, "Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry, Carolyn, but there are only 3 days this month that I couldn't be there." That happens to be one of them. And so my request was, could I appoint an alternate, as we discussed in our prior meeting, to come and sit in for him during that particular day? And Tom, I hear what you're saying. So if we want to do something different, I kind of thought we had an agreement that we understood that it may be necessary somehow. And it's just one meeting. It's not like someone doesn't want to do it. I have an alternate who has agreed to sit in, but people couldn't be there. And that's what I was requesting, if I could follow through.
Commissioner?
I just don't want to lose continuity. I want somebody to be able to report back to me.
I agree, but I never understood we were appointing alternates. So my issue is probably the third one he's going to bring up, and if that is, in fact, the case, I would have a little bit of an issue with people coming and going if they were not part of the group. I think there's something to be said about being part of that task force or that team. And so I don't know how the other people would feel with people coming and going. And I don't remember ever understanding we were supposed to bring an alternate's name back. I did not know that.
I don't know who our three guys were. Maybe it was the mayor and me and another person.
I think it could have been me, Commissioner. But I think Commissioner Soto.
Yeah, just what's the ultimate size of the group? Is the group now going to be...
Currently with six commission appointees, we're at 12, and then we have another 8 appointees, so we'll have 20 appointees.
And then how are the other 8 appointees?
That's the third item. There seemed to be some confusion. The staff report
Can we hold off on going to that, Randy?
Kind of deal through.
Yes. Yeah, let's deal with this.
And
only because I understand.
Commissioner Seidel also.
Yeah, no, I would think that, if you have 20 people, the alternates to me would be more if you had a next commission coming forward. Someone could learn how to do it, but this is just the one thing.
I tend to agree with the, I think, the majority of the commission. I think we have 20 people that will be appointed. I take your point. It's in the minutes that way, but I tend to agree with the majority of the commission. I think that if we have a board of 20, if one has to step aside, I think we're still in pretty good shape.
So probably another way to work that would be just to, it's open to the public. So if they come and sit in, they can help.
Absolutely.
Fill them in on anything. I can help. That's
great. Thank you, Commissioner. Randy, are we clear on that?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
The third item was how the remaining 6 to 8 members were supposed to be appointed. The staff report said that they'd be appointed by the original 10 that were appointed. I've heard from some commissioners that it did not hear it that way and thought that perhaps staff was going to recommend the appointees for the remaining that the commission would then vote on, or that perhaps the commission would somehow as a group decide on those remaining members. So I wanted clarification on that issue.
Steve, Mike, Mr. Mayor.
You're no longer Steve, Mr. Mayor. No, Steve. I'm used to that.
My understanding of the process going forward after we had appointed people, staff had a list of, I'll say, potential groups of, whether it be a representative of industry or of the arts or something. They had a list of, not people, but of
skill
interests or skill sets. that they were going to bring to, potentially bring to the steering committee and say, here are other skill sets that we believe should be included in that committee, and that they were not necessarily appointing individuals, but were allowing the steering committee to then go forth using those as a guideline to find individuals to complete the roster.
So you always understood the steering committee to that point?
Yes. So
to nominate and have us appoint or to appoint?
I'm personally comfortable with them appointing on their own and whatnot. I mean, my image was that we were empowering the steering committee to go forth, and that they would be allowed to fill those extra spots, not necessarily with our involvement.
I had a different understanding.
And I
did too. That's why I brought it up to Randy.
My
understanding was that when we listed those eight different people, because I remember we kept counting how many people this was, and it was going to be 18. And then I would not take away from those eight categories. Those categories are very specific.
Right.
And one of them is a religious person. Mm-hmm. We have all these different specific categories. I don't know why I was under the impression, but I thought that for some reason we as a group were going to appoint those eight people also.
I have no problem with that. It was just my understanding that
I did wonder how we were going to get those names out in front. I don't want to give two of those eight to Commissioner. I would like to just add two more people and keep those eight names. But I did want to have something to do with those eight names, okay?
So guys, I think we're a little fluid on this. So why don't we decide what we want to do? Because
right.
I think there was some confusion. Is that fair?
That's
good. Do we need a motion or something?
I understood Tom's way of viewing it, but I like Sarah's way of doing it. So I'm very flexible here.
Yeah, I'm fine if the steering committee brings the final members back to us for approval.
Well, we don't need a motion, but Sarah, why don't you state exactly? Because I think there is.
I would like for the commission, not the steering committee, for the commission to appoint the additional eight names. Okay.
And how would you like those to come to us?
Can I ask for clarification?
I don't know how. That was what I was waiting on. I thought for some reason all we did the first night was bring our two names, okay?
Right.
And then that I thought the entire group of 18 were the steering committee. So the other thing that I've heard here is that we're separating this group and making 10 people the steering committee, and
no,
I don't
no,
want
no.
to do
no,
that.
Ten, okay. No, sir, let me be clear, Sarah.
Sorry,
the original, the 10 that we are that are
right.
currently appointed, they're just the beginning of the steering
right.
committee. The other eight that joined, and now the other 10 that joined,
right.
will be part of that steering committee.
And that's why I thought for some reason all of those names were going to somehow or another come in front of us.
And the only variant I have of that, Sarah, is that I was under the impression that the steering committee was going to bring the last eight or whatever that number is to us
for approval.
As opposed
and
to
I thought staff was bringing that forward, so that's
yeah.
Where, yeah, that's what I'm saying. How do we want to handle it going forward?
So how do we want to do it?
Well, I would propose that we have staff. Staff is intricately involved with a lot of these areas. Mm-hmm. They have a much deeper ties into the roots through the advisory boards, through some of this. I would prefer staff bring those eight, and again, multiple people from each area to the commission for approval of the last eight.
I'm fine with that.
I like that.
Is that acceptable?
I'm fine with that.
As opposed to having I was pretty good with having the
steering committee.
I was okay with that. I know that was the original discussion.
My only concern is I think there's some people on the steering committee who, while they're valuable assets to the community, may not have the tentacles into some of those areas. And I think staff probably does through their work with the advisory boards.
I'm fine with it either way.
Okay.
Well, we also have a picture now because we have a steering committee so far that has all men but one woman. Okay, hate to be the one to bring that up, but I will tell you that I don't want a committee of the only men, okay? And so I really want us to look at that, and that's something we now know, and staff can look at that, but I mean, that's the kind of thing we know now.
Okay. So next commission meeting, Dory, would you be prepared to kind of bring forward names? Fantastic. And Greg, Commissioner, you'll bring forward here too?
Yeah, I have a good idea already.
Okay.
Yeah.
So are we set then?
Is that yes, sure.
Thank you, Randy.
Thank you. That concludes my report. I'd be glad to answer
any questions. For
quick,
city manager?
Quick question for the city manager. Randy, on the Fairbanks Electric, we see this is coming before us sometime in April or May. I'm assuming that's just the contract?
Yes,
or,
the contract, great.
And kind of timeline after that is contract would be hopefully agreed to in short order, and then?
It's about a 12-month project. Jerry, what's the 18-month project once we sign the contract?
And that 18 months includes it's going to go out to bid,
yes.
And it's not going to be under construction for 18 months, but within that time. Okay, thank you. That's all I have.
Anything else, Mr. Chairman?
I just want to clarify two things, if that's all right, Mr. Mayor. First is, how many trees did we plant last month? I see another 50, is that right? The reason I bring that up is I keep hearing that we missed our mark, and I want us to remember that that was our goal, and it looks like we're achieving that goal. And the other one is about the railroad crossing that still we get people asking us about, and we're on target with that. But just explain in case people haven't been to all these other meetings.
Okay. The rough railroad crossings, primarily the one on Pennsylvania and Webster that you can lose your car in, they are out to bid, and I'm looking for Troy. It was April 1st, roughly, when their bids were due back. And so then it's however long it takes them to evaluate those bids and then get the contractor in place. Now, keep in mind, this contractor is for the entire run of the tracks through the SunRail corridor. So they may not start in Winter Park, though we're pushing for that. We did throw some asphalt in the one at Pennsylvania just real quickly.
The truck went down with it.
Right. Late at night, right? Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Sure. That's all. Just
anything
wanted
else
to clarify.
For the
That's
city
it.
Manager? All right. Thank you, Randy.
Yes, sir.
Larry, city attorney's report.
Nothing to report.
Any questions for the city attorney? Sarah's got something.
I'm so sorry to have to ask this question, but the paper today, and people are asking me now about the red light cameras, and we do know we had some notice last two weeks ago about that. Is there anything new that we need
Nothing
to be
new.
Concerned about?
To my knowledge, it hasn't been served yet. Chris Martin's the risk manager there. I haven't heard that it's even been served on the city. I forwarded a copy of the lawsuit to the clerk, but I could send it. It's basically challenging the post-Mark Wandahl ordinances and how they're
okay.
operating. It turns on a City of Hollywood case out of the 4th District Court
right.
of Appeal, Arum, where people that used ATS, American Traffic
right.
Signals, ATS, and this city uses GATSO, which has different procedures. ATS was making the charging decision, at least that's what the 4th DCA
okay.
found, not the traffic infraction officer that's an official of the city. So we believe on the merits, the city of Winter Park is going to be okay. But as a practical matter, because I'm representing a number of cities in red light litigation, pre-Mark Wandahl and post, the program is controversial and it will continue to be controversial.
Okay.
It will continue to be the subject of legislative initiatives and
right.
that we can't control. But I think the current program in Winter Park is lawful.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Anything else for the city attorney?
No, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Jerry, non-action items, decorative lighting. This came out of a conversation we had at the last commission meeting regarding Palmer Avenue. The last two commission meetings, I think.
Two commission
yeah.
meetings.
And you have this great little...
I do.
Your wife's going to be missing that at home, Jerry.
I'm sure she will.
I'm not missing that.
That and the moose out. I mean, that's the... You guys hit me up here? Thank you very much. Where's the power switch?
We're dark here, too.
All right.
He's using the laptop.
There you go. Thank you very much.
Hey guys, we're dark up here. There we go. Okay.
You got it?
Got to warm up. There we go.
Mr. Mayor, I'm Jerry Warren, the director of your electric utility. As you pointed out at our January 26th meeting, we were talking about lighting Palmer Avenue, and that generated a whole dialogue, and that's basically the purpose of my presentation tonight, to further the dialogue. At the January 26th meeting, we proposed to you options to improve the lighting on Palmer Avenue. Basically, as a result of that, to go back and listen to the minutes, it'll be a little confusing, but you guys asked us to come back with thoughts, perhaps a plan on how we might add decorative lighting to our collector roads. And so basically, I'm back here to tell you what we've learned, what we've discovered since January the 26th. First of all, I think it's important for you to know what our standard is. Our standard lighting is wood pole, concrete pole, with a cobra head fixture that mostly is high-pressure sodium, can be LED fixtures as well. The primary purpose of our streetlight standard is public safety. It's not necessarily one of aesthetics. We install decorative lights in this community for three reasons and three reasons only. One, somebody pays for them. Sometimes it's the developer putting in a new development. They want decorative lighting on the streets that are adjacent to their development, and they pay for them. Sometimes we have a streetscape project. Normally they're funded by the CRA, and they pay for the decorative lights. We offer decorative lights as private area lights, and so if a customer comes to us and wants to put them on in their private area, they pay a rental rate, and we'll do it that way. The third way is what we call a neighborhood lighting project. It's a lot like a bricking project, or you remember we had the plug-in putting lines underground in neighborhoods. And in that case, we create an estimate, the neighbors vote on it, and if two-thirds say yes, then we will install the decorative lights, and then we put an adder on their electric bill, which funds the decorative lights. So that's basically streetlight policy. No decorative lights, unless somebody else pays for them, and those are the three ways in which we pay for it. So basically, we've had some complaints. Some of you particularly have had complaints from citizens about poor lighting on Palmer. Joggers apparently use it as a favored jogging venue in the wee hours of the morning before it's daylight. And so staff brought you some possibilities. You know, we love decorative lights in this community, so we did bring the decorative lighting option forward. It was nearly $200,000 to put decorative lights on Palmer. Not only expensive, it certainly violates our street lighting policy. And so we would not recommend that for that one reason, because now it creates all sorts of equity issues throughout the community. The least cost strategy was to do some trimming around some of the existing fixtures. One of the problems you have is most of our street lights are on existing overhead pole lines, and we have cobra head light fixtures installed on these poles, and these poles are here for 30, 40 years, and of course the trees over a 30 or 40 year period grow up and cover up the street lights, and a street light up in the trees doesn't do much good. So the least cost alternative was to do some pruning and then to add 13 additional LED lights in areas that it was particularly dark, and that was estimated to be about $39,000. If there is a downside to that, it's certainly least cost, and it's consistent with our policy, but you know, you'd have a hodgepodge of lights, some high, some low, some LED, some high pressure sodium. And so we said, well, we looked for a middle ground, and the middle ground was to take down all the existing street lights, install new ones for the whole street, but put in LED regular roadway type lighting. And that price was $62,000. That gives you more expensive, not decorative, and certainly much lesser cost than doing decorative on the whole street. So basically, as a part of this discussion, the question was asked, what would it take to put decorative lights on our collector roads? And so staff went back and said, okay, question number one, What are collector roads? And we have 22 of them. They are streets with low to moderate capacity roads, which basically move traffic from our neighborhoods onto our arterial roads. Basically, they're roads that have traffic flows of 10 to 20,000 vehicles per day. So to put that in the context of a Fairbanks or a Loma or Orlando Avenue or Lee Road, those are arterial roads. And the traffic count on those roads might range from, say, 27,000 to 48,000, and average being around 38,000 vehicles a day. So collectors are busy roads, but they're not anywhere near as busy as our arterial roads. We got 22 of them. Here's the list. And there are, these are all B roads that are not unfamiliar to you. And you see over in the right-hand column, we came up with a planning level estimate to do decorative lights on each of these roads. And at the end of the day, it's a $2.5 million tab to do it. Very expensive to put decorative lights. I don't know whether it matters to you. It would matter to me. I'm the director of your electric utility, and we only serve inside an area that was the city of Winter Park in 2003 when the arbitration took place. I noticed one of the roads on here, Clay Street, is not in an area that I provide service to. That may or may not be important to you, but I did want to, I want to make that note. So served in an area by Duke. Now, just so you get a perspective, it cost about $2,500 for a decorative fixture. Of that, $1,200 is the pole, $350 is the light fixture, the conduit is $800, and the cable is about $150. So you can see out of the $2,500, just about 50% of it is the expensive fluted Sternberg poles that are our standard. So if you've got $2,500 each and about 53 per mile, you see that it's about $132,500 a mile to use decorative lights.
Jerry, what's the difference between, what's the average pricing for the other type of pole, the concrete?
I don't have the price available for concrete. It's significantly less.
50%?
Probably 50%.
Okay. Plus, it takes fewer of them. I mean, that's
right. Part of it. Yeah, sure, the spread.
Now, he's talking about replacing the Sternberg fluted pole, for instance, with a concrete fluted pole.
So it's still the
and,
same.
And
so
we have, we can, you know, we can do it in concrete. We can do it concrete colored black. We can do it in composite. There are a lot of material alternatives available to the very expensive cast iron Sternberg that we use. And so, you know, maybe
so,
that's
so did we decide to do that expensive Sternberg and not go with concrete at some point?
Years ago, that was the standard selected by the commission on what the what the decorative lights would be. Certainly a decision that could be changed.
So one of the things you're saying is that we have the top-of-the-line decorative pole,
right.
Okay? We could still go with a decorative pole that might even be half as expensive, but it would still be a decorative pole.
Rollins doesn't use the pretty fluted poles that we do. They use a black aluminum pole. And they pay $500 a pole. So, I mean, you can see there's the opportunity here to do something less expensive.
Sorry, Jerry, go ahead.
Just a couple pictures of a recent streetlight project. This is East Reading Way. And you see the one of the benefits of the decorative poles, that it is our standard. You can also incorporate them into the street sign poles. And so they're very lovely, and they certainly are the addition of an aesthetic benefit to the neighborhoods. So, you know, one of the strategies we thought about is if we're going to do this, is the most effective, cost-effective way to do it would be to implement them at the same time that we do the undergrounding project. So in other words, we're doing an undergrounding project on Palmer, that would be the time that would make sense to do the decorative lighting. So when we schedule that, we do the underground at that time. There's a couple of complex subtleties, you know, in my mind, refinement of that. You know, some of our undergrounding projects have, there are more than one project involving a road. And so the question is, when you do the first project, do you light the whole road or do you just light it in the sequence of the undergrounding projects? I view that as a refinement, but that's something we could think about. This slide probably doesn't mean that much to you, but it's the collector is listed down to the left, and then the underground projects, which are important to us, is listed in the middle column. So you see some of them are completed, and what I mean by completed is the underground project is complete, not decorative lighting. And you see the project numbers there. And then in the rightmost column, you see a description of the projects. We take that information and translate it into basically a phased budget. And this comes directly from the phasing of the priority list of our underground program. And you see that it would result in 2015 an extra expenditure of about $600,000. Just to put that in context, we're spending $3.5 million in 2015 in the undergrounding project itself. So $600,000 is a lot of money in the context of that year's project. 2016, it would be $266,000. 2017, $417,000. When we first did our priority list, the last 5 years, which is 2019 to 2023, we did not have it broken out by year. And so that's why you see that lumped into one one five-year term. And again, you know, it adds up to the $2.5 million. One of the things that's interesting to note here, these are the ones associated with the undergrounding project, and then that leaves us with these that Clay, for instance, is in the Duke service area. There is not an undergrounding project. And then some of these have already been completed in terms of the undergrounding project, and we'd have to go back and do the decorative lighting. And they add up to about $700,000, and the total is the $2.5 million.
But you put the conduit in place to do this, sir.
Yes, ma'am.
And some of these streets actually already have decorative lighting.
There is some decorative lighting just as a result of the neighborhood projects. That is correct.
But this assumes all new.
Yes, ma'am. It does. It
does. Okay.
February, you know, other considerations. In February 2013, when we brought to you a whole host of undergrounding issues that we wanted you to address, we looked at the possibility, well, what if we put decorative lighting in the entire community? And we estimated that at $16 million. You probably recall at the time that our undergrounding budget was about 40. So $16 million in that context was a really big number and represented about 4 years worth of undergrounding. We couldn't get answers to all of our issues, but at least at that point in time, back in February, March 2013, there seemed to be a consensus on the commission to not slow undergrounding down and fund decorative lighting citywide. So we kind of put that in abeyance. Your staff and your utility advisory board recommended against including decorative lighting in the underground program. Basically, the point of view was we had three issues. Bury the primary, which was about $40 million, decorative lighting, about $16 million, and then the service wires from our system to the home represented about another $25 million. Everybody said, almost, if there was any agreement on anything, is let's get the underground wires in fast, and let's not worry about decorative lighting and the service wires at this point. And that's kind of was our takeaway from that very difficult discussion. We have quite a few neighborhood projects. This is a listing of them. When we first started doing these things, we did them. We would take the vote, and if we got the two-thirds affirmative vote, we would add it as a non-ad valorem tax to the annual tax bill. And we've got 604 customers in that category. Following state statute to do that is pretty complicated. Lots of hearings, lots of administrative bureaucracy. At some point, somebody said, we have a better idea, and the better idea is just add a charge to the monthly electric bill. And so you can see we've got 304 customers under that. So we've got almost 1,000 customers that have either elected to have an adder put on their electric bill or an adder put on their tax bill. And our revenues for that in 2014 were $51,000. So that decorative light program is ongoing.
Jerry, are these households or residents?
I'm not sure what.
Those are households, because like Timberland Shores is listed in there as a whole group.
I want to make sure. Well, you said residents. I didn't know if it went with them if they sell.
Oh, it's the household. Okay. It's an ownership thing.
Yep.
All right. So, you know, here are our observations. Decorative street lighting is $2.5 million if we did it on all the collectors. You really have two funding options. One would be the general fund. You certainly don't have the budget freedom in the general fund budget as it currently stands to fund it. You could do it from the electric utility, but I'll make it clear, you know, basically we spend all the money that you budget, and you know, we pay for our operating expenses, our purchase power expenses, our contract with INCO, utility services, all those things, and then everything that's left over pays for our capital, and right now that's funding our undergrounding. So if you take $500,000 and say we're going to start installing decorative lights, truth of the matter is it's coming out of our undergrounding. If we were to do community-wide, you know, you're looking at $16 million. One of the problems that we have to fret about here is we have all these neighborhood projects that has been added to their bills, and we have streetscapes that may be funded by the CRA. We've got developer-funded stuff. What in the world happens if we make the policy decision to say, we're going to put decorative lights everywhere? Are we going to go back and refund the money to these people that have been paying adders on their property taxes or paying adders on their electric bill? So those are the kind of equity issues that we think complicate the consideration of this. As a result of this whole thing, I've had a number of questions about what does an LED fixture look like? What is, you know, what does our standard look like? And so I want to show you something. Isn't this a great lamp? This is what an electric utility director has. It's been in the business for 40 years. All right. So, incandescent light fixture. We all got it. And this is a magical device that changes electricity in the room. Right before your eyes. Seconds. I am going to change this incandescent light fixture. Into LED. So the question of what does an LED light fixture look like has less to do with the fixture and more to do with the source of the fixture. And this will do light fixture, interesting enough. It's called a corn cob. One of the things is, although these little LED modules in here put out an awful lot of heat, you know, to have to spend on a few minutes, you don't burn your hand. By our industry, it looks like a lot. This is designed to retrofit the high pressure assembly fixtures that we have scattered throughout our city and permanently LED. So, in really simple terms, and I've got a couple here to show you, this is our sort of traditional decorative light fixture that we have scattered around our community. I can turn it into an LED light fixture with one of these. Now, out of $2,500, Terry, where are you?
Right here.
It's $100 extra to do that, so, you know, not a big deal. This, I don't know if you can see it very clearly or not, but there is a short concrete pole with what's called a cobra head fixture on it. That's our standard roadway lighting fixture. And this particular one is an LED fixture. And so if you said, what's an LED fixture? That's an LED fixture. Now, one of the things that's interesting, if you look closely at this, mostly this is designed, you know, with a socket that can screw into a high-pressure sodium bulb fixture. But there are little flat plates on here. And because of the nature of that, a cobra head that is an LED cobra head can be very slim in its appearance. Here's one. Very modern looking thing, and here's another one. One of the beauties of an LED fixture, which gives it some advantages over high pressure sodium, not only does it use way less electricity, I don't think that's a good thing, because remember my magic device that turns electricity into money. It turns way less into money with one of these. So, but you can focus very well LED lighting. And so you notice the very flat, downward focus. And these are dark sky compliant, and many communities are moving to dark sky compliant lights. And with the LED fixture, it's a cutoff type luminaire, which means the light's focused very much down on the pedestrian and roadway surfaces. So, you know, that it does have those advantages. They still cost considerably more than high-pressure sodium. Our standard is high-pressure sodium. We're having more and more customers. You remember last, I think it was at the last commission meeting.
What costs more, the bulbs?
Yes, okay. And the fixtures. As a result, the fixtures. So the fixtures.
I thought you just said you could use the same fixture.
We can, okay. but then we have to pay an extra $100 or whatever for the bulb.
So it's
but generally speaking, you're only paying a few hundred for the light fixture, so generally it's about 2 to 1.
Okay.
So it's more expensive. One of the things is LED. The LED technologies are pretty new, and you know we're monitoring the technology. But you know there's complaints that vibration tends to reduce significantly the life of these devices. So what happens when you put them on a road next on a street light next to a brick road? We're not sure. And so until we see better cost comparison, until we get more data on whether they really can endure in our kind of a world, we're probably not going to move to saying, yep, we embrace them. We're having more and more customers ask for them, and when they want them in the rental world, we certainly will give them to them. And my guess is in a few years they will become our standard, but right now not.
So you have some pilot programs.
No.
Yes, pilot programs.
We have some in place. I don't know that we call them pilot programs, but we do have some in place.
Well, Commissioner Cooper, actually, just asked a question I was going to ask. We did that with the Urban Forestry Management Plan. We set aside neighborhoods.
Right.
Is there an opportunity to,
yes,
to identify a neighborhood?
Of course.
Minutes,
question number one, are we going to do it decorative or are we going to do it more traditional cobra head roadway lighting?
You know, I'd love to see that recommendation.
Well, and I'd like to say that this is the first time I've ever heard that we were paying actually three times as much money because of what it is we're putting in when it looks at our decorative light. If we can get a decorative pole for a third of what we are paying, I don't understand why we're still paying, unless you're going to tell me in the next hand that it's a better long term, you won't have to replace them. But I haven't heard any of that. So I was here when we did the 2013 conversation, and I agree we should not be using the $40 million we need to get the lines underground. But here's my other idea. Right now it looked to me like when you put these poles in, the places that are already done, you already spent the money for the cable and the conduit, the $800 and $150. You don't have to spend that again.
Right.
Okay, so you're already taking those out. So that's from going from $2,500 less $950. So what would happen if you didn't spend $1,200 for a pole? Just let me finish.
Okay.
You spent $500 for a pole that was just as durable and just as attractive, and then you end up with an $850 cost. I mean, I've never known we had a choice, and so I think that we have to look at that.
Commissioner, I think we do need to look at less expensive poles. I agree with that.
Okay.
But understand that in our standard roadway lighting, 30-foot tall poles, cobra head heads that reach over, even though we're putting in the conduit and the cable that will accommodate the future, we're going to be putting in way more light fixtures. And so the fact of the matter is, it's not just a deduct like you have.
So it, you might be putting in, you said, twice as many.
Right.
Okay. All right.
I want you to
follow that. Okay.
I'm sorry.
Jerry,
would you tool back a couple of slides?
Okay.
I still call them slides.
Sorry.
So they're with
all here.
I know they're images on the internet, but I still call them slides.
Oh, there are slides.
I go back. I think the 30,000 foot question is,
yeah,
what do we want the city to look like?
That's exactly right.
And so you have concrete. You know, you have that gray concrete pole with the big old 1950s cobra head hanging off of it, and like that. Is that our city image? Back up another one. Or I'll say is, and again, we, you know, there's your neighborhood image. We have these in a double fixture that go down Morris. We have these with a hanging fixture that go down Fairbanks now. The first question in my mind is, what do we want the place to look like?
Yes.
We can solve the look using concrete or LED or something else, but I think the overall thing is, what is, as we go forward replacing or adding new lights, what do we want it to be? Do we want the furniture to match or not? Right now, we've got a borgish morgue. I mean, there's probably seven or eight different light poles around town here that just...
It looks awful, right?
They're standing up because, you know, I don't know how, but they're still there. So, to me, the first question is, what do we want it to look like? And I'm more on a, I'll call it some form of decorative. I agree there's much less expensive ways to go than where we're going. The question then rolls into, our collector streets different than residential streets? Because we do, I'm on that list of folks that are paying a little bit extra to have decorative lights in my neighborhood, and it's kind of like, gee whiz, would I feel a little chided on that? Probably would if somebody else were getting it for free and I'm still paying for it. But if you, I don't know if collector roads are a different category than residential streets or not. If that passes the straight face test, then that might be the way to go. But I would very much like staff to come back and say, okay, you know, rather than focus on the 40, you know, what can we do for less, and where can we do it, and what kind of policy can we come up with? Because we can get squirrel down with all different technologies and all different heads and everything else, and, you know, it's like picking out wallpaper. I mean, there's 50 different ones that we can look at. Right? The first question is, what do we want our city to look like? And
go from there.
And then for me, the first question is, what do we want the city to look like? The second question is, what budget are we talking about spending? And because for me, the undergrounding budget, for me, is important that we move forward with undergrounding and that we not deteriorate that budget too much. On the other hand, I think that these lights in our community are absolutely beautiful. They speak to what Winter Park is, and that's what I would like to see. And so the question becomes, when do we see it? What budget do we pay for it out of? And then how can we make it as reasonable as possible? And do we do it with the underground? So for me, Sarah, I know that this was something that you brought up. I think it's an excellent idea. I'm thrilled to support that. I'm not so thrilled to support it out of the undergrounding budget. But if we can work to a place where we can find a way to make it reasonable and pay for it, I would love to see a certain amount a year be budgeted out of the general fund to pick this up and do it in process.
Yeah, having been part of that 2013 Utility Advisory Board that made those recommendations, I do know a bit about this. But we did struggle with the issue of the connecting the houses and paying for the lighting with regards to folks like Tom that had already paid for it for his lighting on his street, and would it be fair? And so what we looked at was the purpose of the undergrounding was to protect folks from next hurricane that came through. That's the first thing we focus on, and harden those systems. So then it became kind of, once you're done with that, then you can use that funding source for other items. So the decorative lighting that y'all are talking about, your point about budget, I think there's a lot of things right now through my campaigning and all the debates we're in, that we heard there's a lot of things that people in the city would like to have done. And I feel I need to get a better grasp on the budget and where the sources are and how we fund those things. I don't have that yet. But I mean, as far as to me, I think decorative lighting is great. How much can be done out of the general fund? How much in the CRA? How much? I don't know those answers, but it's what do we? We also want more trees. So how do we? So to me, it's more the overall budget and understanding instead of kind of picking and choosing and then prioritizing those items. These are the items we want to see, and these are schedules we can come up with. And the forecast for the taxes was something I wanted to the revenue of those taxes with prices going up. Lots being redeveloped from older houses to newer houses. How much more revenue are we going to have, and how solid are our numbers for the next 5 years? And then so maybe we can start to make some plans if we have more money coming in from all the development deficits.
Jerry, are you finished?
I was just going to suggest that one way that we as staff can advance this conversation is to come back with some alternatives to the expensive poles, and they're very expensive, and see if there's a strategy that gives us aesthetically what we're after that saves some serious money.
Commissioners, I realize there's budget challenges and there's all kinds of challenges. My thought is, as we looked at those three alternatives, I don't want to pay for things two or three. I don't want to do stopgap measures. And so my thought about how do we want them to look would be, as we have funds available to do this, we ought to decide here's what we want our city to look like, and these are the type of things we ought to be doing to make it look like that, as opposed to let's jerry-rig something real quick and we'll just hang some lights on things and get by with that. So as we go forward, I like to pay for it once.
Jerry-rig?
Jerry will help you, Jerry.
That was my point. I just don't want to pay for things twice. Let's do it right the first time and right. Move on.
Absolutely.
So getting back to the question at hand, we have three recommendations or three options in front of us specifically for Palmer.
For Palmer.
Do we think that, Tom, because I agree with you, do we think that we need to do anything on Palmer just yet? Is it a hazard? Are we concerned enough to spend a certain amount of money on that street?
Mr. Mayor, I would ask staff in the context of there's established foot candle levels for different types of streets, and I would want to know, first off, are we
meeting this?
I mean, health, safety, and welfare is our first consideration.
Exactly.
And so if we are not meeting established foot candles on Palmer, I'd say, yes, we need to do some action. If we are,
Jerry, I don't know that without having...
I think there's a couple things to say here. Number one, you don't have a standard. Number two, you don't want a standard.
No, I'm saying that there are national standards.
There's a test of reason.
Well, we may not have that within the city, but nationally...
You know, the dilemma that a standard creates is you go down half the streets in Winter Park and they don't come close. And so you pull out your wallet and you say, we have a standard.
Yeah.
So I'm just, you know, because you're, from that context, you're right, you know, where do you go, but I'm still, I mean, if there is a perceived, is it a problem or is it a perceived problem?
Okay, so in Palmer, let's...
It is a problem. I mean, when I drive down Palmer early in the morning, it is a problem that I am afraid I am going to hit someone who's running in the road. That's where all this came from, if you'll recall. We started talking about that, and then we said, we can't just do Palmer unless we looked at all the collector roads, and I agree with that. I don't know that we should do Palmer in any one of these three ways without, first of all, at least finding out what you just suggested. Is there a way staff can bring back to us more data that we can make a more informed decision and make perhaps Palmer one of our first areas to deal with? Because that's what I'd like to say. And I, first of all, you did a great job. Thank you. You did a great job of showing me exactly what they look like and explaining it. And so I appreciate this because I think it helps all of us re-explain it to other people. But part of the reason that I make an issue about this is that I don't want our city to continue to have haphazard-looking poles. I would rather us...
We're taking them down as fast as we can.
And you are, and I know that, but I want a plan, much like our urban plan for trees, that's going to show us how that is. So I think we're all on the same page. What I'd like to see is more data and maybe making Palmer the first area to look at.
We're happy to bring you back more data.
Well, that is how we make decisions.
Yes, ma'am. I understand that.
And the other thing that happened is having Greg up here now who was on that decision making, mm-hmm. I'm still curious at times that we haven't gone that last step, which is you're going to have to do this sooner or later, people. I mean, really and truly. Now, I know maybe that's going to happen when I'm gone from here, but I know that that's a big decision we as a community have to look at. And so I know that those are the hard decisions, but that's what we get paid the big bucks to do.
And Jerry, as you go back and look at it, I do think that I noticed there were three different references to list of streets.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we call them key streets. And I don't think that this list of collector streets, it may be over and above what we would really want to tackle. I think there's some streets on there that maybe don't belong on there, even though they are collectors. So the question becomes, when you look at that list, is there a way to move the criteria to a point where it makes sense?
I wouldn't want to put clay on your list.
Right, that's one thing. And then the other thing I wanted to ask you about was, because I did go back through all those old meetings mm-hmm. to prepare for this, and I know that when we originally started talking about this, that second question was, what do we do with the poles that are holding the service lines that are going to the houses? And I went back in the March meeting, and the reason I noticed this is because I rode down Palmer, and I looked at the hodgepodge of different kind of poles, the poles leaning over to the side, and the service poles that were still there with the house blocks on them.
Mm-hmm.
And they did look horrible. So I went back, because my understanding of our meeting, and I was correct when I found it, was that what we decided as a commission in our... And it was a very sloppy meeting. I appreciate that. But what it said in the minutes, in addition to the audio that I listened to, was two commissioners agreed that we should, at our cost, put the service drops underground. A third commissioner agreed, yes, we should do that, but only in the front. So I think it's fair to say, and we may need to ask ourselves that question again, but I think it's fair to say that at that meeting, we decided as a group that three of us agreed that the drops in the front should be put underground, and yet they're still there. So I don't know. I know that's a $25 million price tag. I get it.
The worst part of it is not the $25 million. You have 14,000 customers. 9,000 have already paid to do it themselves.
In the front.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, what do you do?
Yeah.
You're going to go back and pay another $27 million to those folks that paid for it?
No, I hear it. I hear the... So then the question becomes, do we tell people it's time to do that?
Well, there will be a point.
There's some of this is time.
You know, what we've learned in talking to other cities that have done this, and there's not very many, we've learned that the strategy is encourage. We've got some incentives to do it while we're undergrounding in the neighborhood.
Right.
And we get 30, 40, 50% that'll opt in if we market. At the end of the day, you're going to be left with a few hundred maybe that are hanging out there that either can't afford or don't want to pay or whatever the reason will be. At some point, we're going to have to declare ourselves an underground utility, and we're going to have to discontinue providing service to those overhead services. A lot of ways you can do that. You can charge them a premium, those that don't want to shift. You got to pay an extra $50 a month. Well, we don't have bucket trucks anymore. If you have a problem with your service wires, you call Palmer Electric and let them deal with it. Those are going to be difficult political issues. They're going to be difficult policy issues.
And I don't think we're there yet. I think there's some timing issues we've got to face. What I think, though, moving forward, commissioners, are we okay to move forward? From what I understand, from what I'm hearing, is we can look at a new policy, Jerry, with a couple different recommendations on some of the procedures.
We will do two things. We will come back with some different pole configurations and see what that does to the total cost. And we'll also come back with some thoughts on how we might winnow down the list of collector streets.
And would you also look at possibly a neighborhood and doing a test study for some of these
sure.
LED lighting solutions?
Sure.
I know a bit about that category
sure.
and the technology's changing daily.
Yep. Absolutely.
And the paybacks, getting a little bit more reasonable.
Right.
So great. Thank you, Jerry. Appreciate it.
Mr. Mayor, if I may.
Yes, sir.
One of the things that we brought to the commission previously was to do it along what I'll call the entrance roads to the city. That we put the decorative lighting on those and do the, and there was some prioritization, I think, to get in some of the undergrounding, but that was something that wasn't, you can come up with that order. So when you talk about trying to do just certain areas,
Commissioner, would you tell me what you mean by an entry road? Just give me an example.
Just coming down Temple, coming up Pennsylvania, the
Winter Park Road.
Right, the ones that people come into the city. So if you're a visitor and you're driving down one of these streets, you're going to see the nice street lights everywhere and the decorative lighting and not see any electric lines in here. And then we went through our prioritization, and I think we took some of that into consideration. But I think when you talk about, the streets that you really want to do, like, driving down Palmer, that's got an aesthetic value to the city, but then how do you fund them? So that's what the second put, that if you have a prioritization just like we did, it's these are more the prioritization for what the city would like to see and focus on that and then develop costs and kind of pare that program down, if you will, instead of trying to look at the entire city, look at what's going to bring aesthetic value to the city and value to all the residents, because when everyone drives in, you're going to see it, and it's a great place.
That could be part of it. Right, Chair? Are you okay making that part of it, Chair? Incorporating that?
Absolutely.
Great. Any other questions? Terry, you got off easy over there.
I was just taking notes. Location.
Great.
Trying to
Thank
build
you
a
guys.
Consensus.
Thank you very much. Wes, all right, is Wes or Dan?
Wes first. Right. Before we get to our comprehensive annual financial report, we'll go over the monthly financial report for January 2015. We're a third of the way through our fiscal year. So I want to cover the general fund first. Things are pretty closely in line with where we expect them to be in comparison to budget. I've got a few items that are ahead of budget just due to the timing of the year, and those are property taxes. We receive the bulk of our property tax money on the front end, the first 5 to 6 months of the year. Our business taxes, those run from October 1 to September 30, so we already have almost all of that revenue. And lastly, if you look down at the operating transfers out, that number is large because we've already made the transfer to the CRA for the tax increment revenue for fiscal year 15. That has to be done in December. So those look like they're ahead of schedule, but they're going to come out right very close to the annual budget. Moving down to the CRA, the next statement, we already have our property tax, our tax increment revenue there from the county, which is intergovernmental revenue, and from the city, which is the operating transfer in. Moving on to the water and sewer fund, we have a positive bottom line for the 4 months ended January 31 of $770,000. We're projecting our debt service coverage to be 2.05, so that's very good. And also, I want to let you know that Standard & Poor's recently completed a rating surveillance of our water and sewer credit. They affirmed our AA- rating with a stable outlook, so that's very good news. Next is our electric statement. And there we have a bottom line there of $431,000. Our fuel costs were over-recovered by about $540,000 for the first 4 months of the fiscal year, and that puts us very close to the midpoint of our target fuel stabilization fund range of $500,000 to $1.7 million. So we're very close to the midpoint, so that's in good, and we project our debt service coverage there to be 2.88 for the year. Those are the highlights for the January report.
Any questions, Mr. Hammond? No, Randy? Commissioner Beck? Do we just need to accept this report?
I would move acceptance.
I'll second.
Great. There's discussion? No? Anybody? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Great. Opposed? Great. Wes, thank you. Are you going to stay up there and Dan join you?
Well, let me just introduce a couple items first. This is one of our highlights of our year, is to present to you our comprehensive annual financial report. This is the result of many hours of work on behalf of our finance department, and our other departments participate, have a hand in the process as well, and it's a lot of audit hours too. Some of the highlights for our fiscal year are an improved general fund balance, what we typically refer to as our reserves around here. Mm-hmm. We went to them from $11.4 million to $12.3 million. Our reserves are a little over 28% of our expenses in comparison to our target of 30%, so we're close. And we know, of course, that we're going to draw down some of that in fiscal 15 for the matching on the quiet zones and replacing our computer system. So that's going to come down some. So I've added another column there in your title sheet there to make a projection for 2015. And I'm projecting that it's going to drop to just above 27%. So it's not a big drop, but it will go down some. In our water and system, we had our utility funds both had strong years, good financial performance there. Our water and sewer system net position improved by $5.2 million. Our debt service coverage was 2.02. Our electric system net position improved by $4.7 million. And our debt service coverage there was 2.85. Both very good. With us today, we have Dan O'Keefe with Moore Stevens Lovelace. He's a partner with our audit firm, and he's going to go over some of the of their what they noted in our audit.
Thanks, Wes.
Good evening.
Hey, Dan. Welcome.
And let's see, I've got a presentation here.
Somewhere.
Yeah. Ah, there we go. Now, is there a little clicker? Okay, gotcha. Okay. if we go to the next slide here, we'll kind of get the presentation moving. And the following, there we go. Wes was kind of giving you a little bit of a highlight in terms of the financial results. Of course, his team is responsible for actually preparing the comprehensive annual financial report, and my team is responsible for auditing that information and making a determination whether or not it's reliable. One thing that's interesting about the government sector, the word comprehensive is really underused, you know, because there's no other type of financial report in America that's more comprehensive than a comprehensive annual financial report. The GASB, which is the Government Accounting Standards Board, is the one that creates this thing. And it's all about accountability. It's all about transparency. It's all about knowing everything there is about your city that can be really found from a fiscal standpoint. So there's far more detail that you'll find in this report than you will ever find in a commercial style report. So it's massive. And with that said, you know, I don't expect you to read through it in a short period of time and glean everything from it. I've always made this offer that if you have any questions or want to meet with me one-on-one, I'm available, you know, 24/7. I can come to your house, you can come to my house, we can meet on a neutral site, it doesn't make any difference, but I'd be happy to answer any detailed questions related to this document. Now, the services and deliverables, that kind of plays into what we have to do. There's a stack of auditing standards we have to follow, those that are prescribed by my profession, those that come from the General Accountability Office of the U.S. government, and then those that are set forth by the rules of Auditor General. The first report that we issue is actually the report on the financial statements. And to me, this is probably the most important one. And what we're giving you there is what's called a unmodified opinion, which is what you want to have. So it's basically telling you that you can rely on the financial information. The next report we give is what's called a report and internal control over financial reporting compliance. In the government world, your financial statements are riddled with compliance issues. So there's controls over the financial operations, and there's controls over the compliance operations as well. So that's kind of what this report accomplishes. We don't actually run an opinion on internal control per se, but there are certain elements that we have to consider when we're performing the audit. We didn't have any findings related to your financial reporting. We didn't find any significant issues of noncompliance. So again, this was a clean report. The next report is required by the federal and state single audit requirements. Because you have federal and state grants, there's a whole other section of the audit that we have to perform. In this section of the audit, we actually have to identify what are considered to be major programs and go in and test compliance of those individual programs. So now our materiality limits drop way low. We're not in the financial statements anymore. We're in a program level. So your reports here deal with the internal controls over compliance on those programs and also the compliance requirements themselves. And again, we based on our tests and results, you know, we had no findings. The next one is the auditor's management letter. The auditor's management letter is something that's required by our state. The rules of the Auditor General specify that you have to produce this document. There are certain areas that we have to specifically address within the management letter, which we have done. And then there's another letter that we have to issue by the rules of the Auditor General dealing with an accountant's report over your investments. And so we have to make certain that your investment policies are being followed accordingly. And this is a report that basically addresses that as well. So this is kind of just our responsibility. So think of our responsibilities is following all the auditing standards and reporting back to you. So that's kind of what you engage us to do. Then management, on the next slide, shows their responsibilities. And basically their responsibilities is to provide us all the information and make certain that that information is accurate and give us access to anything that we ask for, which they have done. And if we go to the next slide, we'll see just kind of the responsibilities for internal control. And as you can see, it's not an opinion, but we have to factor that into our test work as we're working through the audit process. And then the next slide deals with compliance. So we don't test every single compliance item that you have going on, but those that they have a direct material impact on the financial statements, we're required to go in and test. And then we have to communicate certain things. There was no unreported or unadjusted differences as a result of the audit. We had no disagreements with management. As far as we know, management didn't go out and shop opinions on different accounting issues. We use what's called a risk-based approach, and that approach really changes from year to year based on where we think the risk is on a particular given year. We also like to try different things or go into different areas from year to year you know, just to kind of mix it up a little bit. We don't just kind of rubber stamp your audit. We try and do things that make sense, but also give you over, say, a three-year period, maximum coverage, you know, in a variety of different areas. We use a variety of different techniques of testing, analytics, benchmarking. And I was talking to Commissioner Cooper earlier. There's a requirement that we have to go in and assess your financial condition using some templates that are set by the Auditor General's office, and it basically benchmarks you against cities of your own size, and also shows a five-year trend analysis in different areas. And you were overall favorable in that particular assessment. And if we kind of move on to the next couple of slides, this is just you know, based on the nature of the work here, we have to assign, you know, governmental specialists to do this work. We also have an IT team that goes in and does a risk assessment of your computer systems. This was the audit schedule that we followed, and as you can see, we're here today presenting the report because you have a deadline of March 31st. This thing has to get filed with the Government Finance Officers Association. And then the next area, I'm going to kind of go over some financial highlights. And the first two slides here, I always throw in when there's a new commission because it just kind of gives you some you know, the language of our world, if you will. Because as you can see in the standard-setting bodies, we have what's called the GASB. In the commercial sector, they have the FASB. So they're two entirely different groups. They don't talk to each other. They don't even like each other. Then we have, if we go back that slide, then we have the financial reporting side, where in the government world, they use a lot of funds. They have budgetary reporting. They have different levels of reporting, you know, based on the organizational structure of the entity itself. In the commercial, it's really boring. It's just a single statement, you know, a balance sheet, an income statement, a cash flow. I mean, it's really unremarkable. But in the government sector, it's far more robust. The basis of accounting kind of varies based on the types of funds that you have. You have what's called full accrual that's used for your enterprise funds and proprietaries, and you have modified accrual that's used for your governmental. The modified accrual is kind of a flow of financial resources, if you think about it. So it's current financial resources flowing through. Commercial, it's all full accrual. On the reporting units, in the government sector, we report in different areas. In other words, the opinion is actually multiple opinions, where in the commercial sector, it'd just be a single opinion. Then the audit standards, of course, are different, as I mentioned before. Budgets are required in the government sector, and they're optional in the commercial sector. The next slide just kind of talks about terminology. When you talk about expenditure, that's a term that you would use in a governmental fund. And expenditures are what go against what's called current financial resources. An expense is something you use in a business or a proprietary type operation, and that's something that you record when it's incurred. So capital, principal payments and debt, things like this in the governmental fund, or expenditures. Well, in a proprietary fund, the capital is capitalized and depreciated. The principal payments pay down the liability that's sitting on the balance sheet, and you only have the interest payments that you show as an expense. Revenue is unique to the government side because that has to be reported when it's measurable and available, where in the proprietary side, it's when it's earned. So you could have earned it, you know, but you're not going to receive it in an availability period of, say, 60 days after year end. Therefore, in a governmental fund, you wouldn't recognize it as revenue. You'd somehow defer that amount. So government funds use modified accrual, proprietary funds use full accrual, and pension trust funds use full accrual as well. So we go to the next slide here. This just kind of gives you a little citywide analysis. Now, you know, Wes basically went over, you know, some of the highlights of the information that he did. I can just kind of tell you from knowing the city for the past 10 years that you're in very good shape, you know, now as you stand at the top level. One of the things I like to do at the top there is look at your current ratio, which is just liquidity. You always want to be this side of one on liquidity, okay? That means your current assets exceed your current liability. So you never want to be under one. That's a bad place to be. So if we look at the next slide, we get into, these were the fund financial statements that we went in and audited these individual funds and have rendered an opinion on these individual funds. So this gets back to this number of reporting units that we have to report on, which is multiples. And we go to the next slide here. This is your mothership, the general fund. And this is the one that you really got to pay close attention to, because when you're looking at that unfunded or the unassigned fund balance, you know, a lot of people think of that as being their reserves, you know, and that really is the amount that you have that, you know, is not committed to anything. It's not assigned anything. You're at 28% in 2014. I always recommend to clients to be on this side of 25%. I really think a city your size needs to be at least 25%. And you know why, because all you have to do is go back to 2004 when we had the asterisk come through, the three hurricanes. If you didn't have those reserves, you would not have been able to get through that whole storm season. So reserves are very, very important. They produce cash flow, which you need because you got a delay in terms of when your property taxes come in. And they also, you know, create that reserve for some type of catastrophic loss. So you're in a pretty good shape right here. So 28% isn't the highest I've seen, but certainly you don't want to be, you know, any lower than 25%. So we looked over at the next slide here. If you look at just what happened on a budgetary basis, and this is, you know, top level, your resources came in to the plus of about 1.3 million, and you underspent your appropriations, so you had a net positive year, you know, from a budgetary standpoint. And if we go to the next slide, this is your proprietary funds. Your proprietary funds also are in very strong condition. If you, do I have another slide? I think I do. No, go back one. I'm sorry. No, forward. There we go. When you look at the fund position in your enterprise funds, you know, I always kind of think back to 2009 when the electric system was in, you know, really, really bad shape. And you look at it now, and it's just really wonderful to look at, because it's really healthy, you know, based on where you've come through, you know, from in the past 6 years. So this, of course, gives you that ability to do the type of things that you were talking about earlier, you know, with that fund. So it's very healthy. It certainly is reflected in your bond ratings, too, because that's another thing that helps you as far as saving money. And then the next slide is just the final thing of the different standards that kind of hit. The big standards that are hitting the government sector are the pension standards. And if you look at nothing else in the CAFR, I just want you to turn your attention to page 97. You may not have it. You could kind of jot it down later. But this is the new standard in terms of how information is going to be presented for pensions. It's unlike anything the government sector has ever seen. And this is basically setting it up for how it's going to appear in the financial statements going next year. So this is calculating what the total liability is, you know, for your defined benefit pension plans for police and fire, and then shows you the assets against that liability. So what's going to happen in your financial statements next year is this difference that's down here, which is called the net pension liability, at your top level statements will actually show as a liability, you know, in your statement of net position. Now, also keep in mind, notice that the percentages are here are different than what you see as the unfunded amount in another schedule over here, because there's a new standard of how this is being calculated. And if you look at the fire side, 95% is where you're at in terms of assets compared to the liability, which is excellent. I mean, that is just excellent in terms of where you want to be. Police is 78%, which isn't bad, but you know, certainly that gives you the idea that you probably got a little bit more work to do to kind of shrink that gap a little bit.
What do we want to be on the other side of, if I can interrupt? if we're on 95, is that what we should be shooting for with the police as well?
Well, I mean, 100% is really your target, yeah. I mean, 100% is really the whole idea behind it is to kind of get rid of that liability if you can. But you may not be able to do it in a single year. It may take multiple years to kind of get you to that point. Good question. And with that, Mr. Mayor, I'll be happy to open up for any questions.
Great. Any questions? Commissioner?
Just a few.
Sure.
The first one was on the management letter. I saw that you had two comments, and I just wanted to say to Wes and those look very insignificant overall to me. Thank you very much. I trust we'll track those on our manager's report until we close that out, but I just want to say well done about that. I've seen a lot of Auditor General statements recently about the use of CRA funds, and did you see any problem going through our CAFR relative to the use of CRA funds?
No, as a matter of fact, that is a very hot item. It's one of the reasons why all CRAs are required to be audited in the state of Florida. Your CRA is treated as what's called a major fund, which forces us to go in and audit and actually opine on that fund. Some entities, what they do is they actually pull the CRA out and have a separate set of financial statements audited, or you can take this approach, you know, treating it as a major fund, which is what we recommend to our clients because we think it's a more efficient way to go. So we actually have to go in and audit those transactions and determine that they're in compliance with state statutes and, of course, how you guys set up the CRA.
From a perspective of government visibility, we are absolutely visible and out there and audited, and our residents can be comfortable.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I feel good about that. I had a question for you on page 85, and what it's talking about here is the let's see what the actual name of this is. It's OPEDS, but it's other post-employment benefits.
Yes.
And I see that we're paying as we go, and we have a rather large unfunded actuarial unfunded liability of about $8 million there. And I'm wondering if there's an industry standard at which we should start funding this. I just don't want to see what happened with our fire and police for us to wait too long to start funding this. And I just need to understand from an industry perspective, is there a threshold?
Let me explain what's causing that, okay? And then that will help you as a group decide how you want to address it. Because this is one of those standards that's very controversial. You know, because in the government sector, what happens is if an employee leaves, you know, retires and leaves, they're allowed to participate on your health care plan until they reach the age of moving into Medicare. Okay? That's a law. That's a law that's on the books, and you cannot change. So every government.
And if I could interrupt, if you look at your sheet we're taking tomorrow, the third bullet down is asking the state to repeal that law.
Yeah.
But until they do, we've got a rapidly escalating liability.
And it's a number that, quite frankly, you know, I don't know how these guys do it, you know, because, you know, in the accountants, we all kind of chuckle about this because it's an implicit rate difference. So the theory is that because you've got an older population participating in your health care plan, it's driving up the premiums. So they're projecting this out and estimating how many employees are going to actually participate in the plan. So, I mean, it's such a loosey-goosey number. I mean, you know, and that's not a technical term, of course, but I mean, it's one of those numbers that really kind of drive us crazy in the industry because it is going, to me, a little bit overboard. You know?
So do you see that different than the fire and police?
Yes, huge, because that is absolute, and there's no question that those liabilities absolutely exist. But I'm hoping, what Randy's hoping, is that the legislature will appeal that requirement, and then all this stuff will just go away.
But if it doesn't, is there a threshold at which, is there some percent of cost to payroll or cost to something that we should kind of say we've got to come back and revisit this now?
Well, you know, I mean, it's a good point because, you know, it's something you could probably go in and probably have staff analyze how many employees are currently participating, you know, on your healthcare system that are retired, and what incremental costs you're currently incurring, you know, because of their participation. It'd probably be an interesting number to see to give you an idea whether or not it's something you want to focus on as far as funding, or whether or not you want to use a continued
really like
pay to go.
To go away, ideally.
Yeah,
you know,
everybody would.
But I just,
yeah.
You know, as we sit here, it's not going away. Then the question is, if you could kind of think about that as a group, mm-hmm. The question is, what is that threshold at which we need to start funding that future liability? It's just a thought. And then the last question I had was, I noticed that we had about $3.8 million in kind of unusual revenues between the federal forfeiture, the FEMA, the Orlando wastewater bond retirement, the arbitration with the underwriters, and the auction rate bond changes, you know, we had. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of dollars there. And some of that went into reserves, some of it's going to pay for SunRail, quiet. Yeah. So there's whole, but my question is, that's an unusual income. If that unusual income had not been there, would we still be okay? Are we still comfortable?
Sure. I would think so, because those revenues in
we're still about 27% probably
factors, and they were offset by costs too.
Right. I would say the biggest chunk of that is the FEMA money that you mentioned, and that
which
was
we're
simply
using for good capital improvement.
But we got that very late. I mean, that wasn't paid out incrementally over the years. We got that last chunk.
Right, and that's basically just giving us back money that we spent many years ago.
Oh, I know. But when I look at a number like that, you know, I would have thought I want to see capital improvements, or I want to see reserve, and we did get both of those pieces, and I think that's a positive thing.
Well, right. If you're looking for the projections for next year, we're still at 27%. So we're still, because we're taking that out to move.
Right.
But I heard someone say, and this is what I need a little explanation on, that it wasn't from me, I think it was from Wes, we'll be drawing down on that next year. So when you say we'll be drawing down on those reserves next year, is that what you were talking about?
Right.
And that's because we have put that portion.
Well, it's because we budgeted to draw down this year.
I'm sorry.
It's because we budgeted to draw that money down this year.
Because we plan to do the quiet science.
Right.
And take the computer system.
And that's what we're talking about.
Yes.
We draw down. That's what I want to make sure.
Any other
questions? I had two quick questions, I hope. Is the 25% to keep on board for the general fund, or the 27 that we have now, you're saying 25 is a number. Is there a specific calculation for that, or is that that's just more of, you know, being in the business, this is a standard business number?
That's Dan O'Keefe's 38 years of being in this business and auditing hundreds of governments in my career. I just think that because I get asked that all the time, and nobody will let me kind of sit down with that, giving them a number. So finally one day I sat down and I rationalized it from a few different steps. One being, how much money do you need on hand as cash, okay, just to cover the normal operations? How much money do you need, you know, for something that kind of pops up with a little bit of uncertainty, and how much money do you really need for possibly some type of catastrophic event? And that's kind of how I came up with that.
Well, where I'm going to go with the catastrophic event is we're underground in our electric system. Shouldn't that risk go down as to how much we would have to need on hand to recover the system?
It will, certainly, but when the 2004 hurricanes, as much as the power lines were hit in Winter Park, we were in the process of buying the system at that time, so we were responsible for a true-up, which meant any capital they spent between arbitration and the acquisition date, we were on the hook for. And the hurricanes, all that devastation in Winter Park was about $800,000 in putting poles back up.
Okay.
So it wasn't as much as you would think.
Right.
Our biggest cost was the cleanup of oak trees and the water mains that got broken and that type of thing. Right. So it wasn't as much as we certainly thought we were in for a huge number.
So it's a good number to use going forward.
Yes.
I just have one other quick question on what Commissioner Cooper was talking about on page 85 with your OPEB cost, our annual cost. That appears, so that's actually what we're spending every year, but the liability is the $8 million number. Am I understanding that right?
Yeah, it's an actuarially computed estimate in terms of what the impact is. You know, so yeah, are you spending it exactly that? Not really certain. You would really have to go back and analyze those costs. You know, but again, it's an actuarially calculated number.
And is that still being phased in to the final number?
Greg, mm-hmm. you say you yes. see it increasing, Commissioner, from year to year.
Mm-hmm.
It's because they implemented this standard a few years ago, but they're allowing us to phase the liability in over time. So it's not really that the liability is increasing rapidly, is we're headed towards a bigger number.
Yeah.
Is the real number.
And here's the bad thing about it, because the GASB's not finished with all this liability stuff. They're going to eventually make you book this, you know, into your statement in that position too, which.
Commissioner Sprinkle.
I just remember that one of the cities or one of these places that when I realized we were running 28% reserves, we were well above any of the cities around us, even the majority of the people in the state. So I felt very comfortable that 28 or even 25, because I remember talking to people that were lucky to have 10.
Yeah,
not that that's anything that we would ever aspire to, but I just can say we are definitely in a place that most people can't even dream about being.
Yet you're an elite group, there's no question.
Any other questions? No.
No, sir.
Great job. Dan, thank you very much.
You.
To Wes, Randy, your group. Electric Utility Waste. Great job, guys. Fantastic. Thank you. Do we need a motion to accept this, Randy?
Yes, please.
I'll move the acceptance of the camera.
I'll second.
Okay, any discussion? No. All in favor?
Aye.
Against? Great. Thank you so much. Are you guys good for
you want to do citizen
questions?
Comments?
Citizen comments?
Yeah, I was going to say,
take a break.
That.
Me too.
Great. Okay, well, let's take comments first.
Yeah, this one.
Anybody, any citizens willing to wish to make comments to the commission, please step forward, fill out your yellow sheets, hand them to our city clerk.
Just come right up to the microphone.
Yeah, please step right up to the microphone and just hand in a yellow. Do you have a yellow
sheet? Yeah, I gave it to you.
Great, thank you.
I'm here really to talk about the...
Just please identify yourself.
Oh, my name is Kiara Ashanti.
Kiara,
right. And I'm here to talk about 808 Raven Circle in Altamont.
Thank you.
I'm here really to talk about the red lights. The program really needs to cease. As you guys have already know, there's about several dozen cases going through the state right now regarding them. You can bet that if you haven't been served yet, you probably will be real soon. Things have happened in Orlando in which the courts have found against them in Orlando specifically, as well as I believe that you guys had to refund five thousand tickets last year in 2014 or something. I understand that the attorney here believes that the law is settled law, but it's one of those laws that I think is frankly a bad law because it's designed specifically to create revenue for the city. That's really what the purpose of these types of programs are here and across the country. Seems like it would be a lot easier and less money and less frustrating for you guys that always have people coming up and having always do through court cases to just pretty much end the program. That's basically what I have to say unless someone has a question for you.
Okay. No, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Page. I'm here on behalf of Rescue Vet Incorporated. We are a federally recognized 501c3. We would like permission from the commission to collect and solicit donations at your special events, including your farmer's market.
Farmer's market. I think we have policies.
We were told by the police department we had to come get your approval. That's why I'm here.
You could take that up with staff.
Yes.
And have you filled out a yellow?
Yes.
Yeah, slip? Thank you. Forget it. Staff will deal with that.
If you can give your information to, is Michelle? Yeah, see Michelle.
Before you raise your hands.
Michelle's the one with the longer hair. Yes.
So all of you put your hands up, except for the chief, put his hand down. Jeffrey.
Jeffrey Blydenberg, 204 Genius Drive. Congratulations, Mayor.
A couple of comments on the light fixture, just to keep in mind. With the sustainability efforts that the city is being awarded, has been recognized for, the whole idea of the dark night, I think, is really important, so that while we're lighting the streets, that's a good idea, lighting the sky is a bad idea. So that would be good to take into consideration in the design review. And then the other is, our sidewalks are already narrower than they should be, hard to change that, but they get even narrower when we put this, whether it's a traffic light, a sign, a light pole in the sidewalk instead of outside of the sidewalk. So if we could set a standard, if it's at all possible, obviously there are times when the city doesn't have the right of way necessarily, but where they have the right of way, to put it so that the sidewalk remains clear for people that are in wheelchairs, for people that are running. We make it really hard to use the sidewalks, and I think we could make it a little bit better. And then finally, just a suggestion on those light poles, I think it would be good to see a physical, really good quality photograph, or even a sample of them, maybe even just samples, of each of the types we're talking about. Because at the end of the day, this is all about what Winter Park looks like. If I wasn't mistaken, I saw something on there that looked like there was a fair amount of money in the electric budget beyond what's been budgeted, but I may be not reading that correctly, outside of the 12 that we have in our general fund. So it would seem like there might for sure be the way to start scheduling that on a yearly basis, that we spend, $400,000 or $500,000 a year and we just figure out where to put it. But first and foremost, get all the design standards right and install them. And the same thing with the electric boxes, all the stuff, it's really getting to be not great, because it's hard because you've only got limited places to do it. But I think that it just needs a little design consideration as that stuff is being done. Because all the stuff that was up in the sky, up in the air, is now down at the street and you can see it even more. So thank you very much.
Thanks, sir. Anybody else? You want to take a quick break?
It's up to you, sir.
Okay. What time do we have?
10 minutes.
5:26. Do you want to just reconvene at 5:45? Is that okay?
That'd be great.
15 minutes.
Perfect.
Great. Thank you. Okay. Our mics are on.
Mr. Mayor, I'd like to pull item D.
Item 10D.
Yes, sir. Other than that, I'd move for approval of the consent agenda.
And I'll second.
Great. Commission discussion on that? No. Would the public like to make any comments on consent agenda, items A through C? Seeing none, no? Can we, do we have to call a roll on this, Randy, or can we just do it by? Okay. Great. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Closed? None. Great. Commissioner McMacken, item 10D.
And I don't know, John or Randy, on the restroom, it wasn't clear in our packet where the restroom was. I know it's in the park, and the site plan was extremely illegible. And I'm just curious as I'll get out about where.
I apologize for the reduction.
The rest of the plans were great, but that's my only question, John. It's really where is it in the park? And
Marcus flipped us down.
Do we have an overhead?
It's getting close.
This is the south end of the park. Comstock is right here. The bowling alley is right here. So this is Rollins Stadium in this area. All right. Right here. It goes out to this point. That's the edge of the fence. The restroom is right here, where it will serve the stadium, the fields, and the basketball
court. Yeah, the basketball courts are okay.
Yeah, the basketball court. Right.
Great.
Right,
that's
what's currently there, John? Just field?
Nothing.
Yeah,
there's a good
mountain
out. Picture of the area.
That sounded a little biased.
John knows I dreamed him crazy about it. John, I would like to speak to that when you get a pause.
That's a good time to do it.
Well, because it was a little frustrating not having a map, and finally I did get out there. My concern about this restroom is not the restroom. I'm delighted that Rollins is willing to build a restroom there. The issue is, as we move further along and become more dense,
The idea of maintaining visibility corridors, Orange Street comes in down here. Mm-hmm. The idea of maintaining visibility corridors of open space, mm-hmm. and you'll notice that Long's took the fence on their field over here. They took the colored paper or whatever it was inside out, so you see through beautifully. And like this has a barrier so that you don't see through it. So right now, you would say you're not reducing open space. You're just going to stick the restroom here, and you couldn't see through there before. But the truth of the matter is the way they've done their fields and the way it makes sense is to open those fields up so that you have open visibility. And I was trying to see if we could consider possibly shifting, and Troy and I got me this morning and looked at it. And I know we have to talk about it a little bit, but my hope was that we could at least have this contract so that we have the option to talk about it.
I guess, John, can you tell us why it ended up there before we get into possibly moving it? Give us a little background.
The consideration was of several different sites out there. One was over close to the basketball courts. The other one was kind of halfway between the softball field and the basketball courts. This one was selected because it was really closer to the the softball stadium, better accommodated. That's what Rollins approached us with a year and a half ago. We want to build a restroom for our softball stadium. So that was the original intent of it. And in looking and working through the agreement, we said, well, we want you to build one of our restrooms. And it was a little large for a couple of the other areas, one being this area right here. And it's there's
which,
two.
Which is where Commissioner Cooper's. That's where your project is.
John, could you? Does this? I don't want to ban the location. I just want the contract to say that we can provide them the site that we've agreed to or an alternative that's mutually.
I guess, Commissioner, if I could interject for just a second, the location that is proposed at, and John, it's, would you put your pencil there?
Yeah.
It's right here in front of the fence.
Correct. It's right there, but your view corridor coming down the road is to the left of that.
Or any place else if we open this road, and I hope that one day we do connect this road over to...
I would hope we'd never put that road through the park.
So I don't mean through the park. I'm sorry. Over to connect to Denver at the end.
I'm looking at that, and I'm saying that is really not in. If I were going to put it somewhere outside of a view corridor, I would put it where it's being proposed because it is outside of that street's view corridor.
That met all of our requirements for servicing our field, the basketball court.
And believe me, I certainly appreciate view corridors because we deal with them all the time, but right. That the view corridor is to the left or to the right of the ball field.
And I would
put it on either, I'd either put it there or I'd put it closer to the basketball courts, but it serves a purpose. I was understanding you until I saw the location of the road, and I'm going like...
Oh, because you're talking about Ward. I'm also talking about the Comstock. I don't mean just Ward. I'm saying that by putting it there, what we do is we lose an additional 20 feet of visibility that we can have through that field to the park. And Tom, the only reason I even... wanted to add, I'm not trying to move it.
John, can we put the other overhead back
on?
Here's
what I'd like you to do is to take a look. If you could can you bring that down so that we can see right beside the ball field on this side, there are already two buildings that block the visibility with lots of room around them that could accommodate the bathroom that wouldn't block visibility. And I'm not trying to dictate where it goes.
Yeah, but I would from a There's two concerns there, and then I'm gonna let it ride. Is that you really have if you're looking at servicing the people you're looking at serving, and John, can you swing? I want to see. Keep going up. Okay, you're good. Right there. You've got three use groups there. You've got the ball field. You've got I'll call it the soccer fields for lack of a better term. And you got the basketball courts. And so I'm either going to put it right next to the bleachers where it is there, or I'm going to move it down to next to the basketball courts, and it's still going to do the same thing.
Well, that's just a batting
cage. Where's Spats?
No, there's stuff all over. I mean, the bleachers are next to the batting cage. I'm real happy with the location from a site.
Well, I understand. I wasn't trying to move it, but I was trying to say that the contract
contract could very easily say, or another mutual agreement, if Troy and Scott Bitterford could sit down and look at protecting visibility for this.
Yeah, but anywhere you put it along there is going to block it.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to put 20. You've got to put a 40-foot building somewhere along that parking lot, and anywhere you put it is doing that. And I'd rather clump it with the other stuff and leave as much of a clear open space as you possibly can to the right of it. So I'm again,
Commissioner, I understand what you're trying to do, Commissioner Cooper. I'm fine with it where it is. I know.
We've got all the utilities available in that location, and it's also in close reference to the parking lot, which is good for a bathroom.
Yeah. No, I'm very comfortable. I mean, if I were locating the bathroom, that is certainly one of the particular spots that I would pick for it.
Well, that was the one we ended up with after a pretty wide selection.
You've been doing it for a while. Well, Commissioner, then I'm going to move 10D, unless there's any...
I'm going to second.
Okay. Sorry about that. Appreciate the conversation, but I think we're...
I just hate to take away more view.
I understand. Great. Any discussion? Any discussion from the public? Seeing none, can we vote on this too? Randy, we can just do this by a simple up and down?
Yes.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, John. Public hearings, who we have? Jeff, are you bringing this forward? We have 12.
Is this the first one is the second reading, so we need the city attorney to read the title.
Gotcha. I apologize.
We have three ordinances in association with this, so if I could read all three titles.
And we'll have a separate vote?
Separate votes, but one discussion.
That's fine. Thank you, Larry.
Yes, sir. So I'll read three titles. Ordinance 2989-15, an ordinance of the city of Winter Park, Florida, annexing the property at 1802 Stonehurst Road, more particularly described herein, providing for the amendment of the city of Winter Park's charter, Article 1, Section 1.02, corporate boundaries, to provide for the incorporation of the real property described herein, providing for the filing of the revised charter with the Department of State, providing for repeal of prior inconsistent ordinances and resolutions, providing for severability, and providing for an effective date. The second is ordinance of the city of Winter Park, Florida, amending Chapter 58 Land Development Code, Article 1, Comprehensive Plan, Future Land Use Map, so as to establish single-family residential future land use on the annexed property at 1802 Stonehurst Road, and to indicate the annexation on the other maps within the comprehensive plan, or more particularly described herein. Third is an ordinance of the city of Winter Park, Florida, amending Chapter 58 Land Development Code, Article 3 Zoning, and the official zoning map, so as to establish single-family R1AA zoning on the annexed property at 1802 Stonehurst Road, more particularly described herein.
Thank you, Larry. Jeff?
At the last meeting, as you know, we had the first reading on annexing the one home at 1802 Stonehurst, so this is the second reading and adoption. Once it's adopted, then we need to put the color in the comp plan maps and establish the same single-family zoning that they have now in Orange County.
And both of these, if I'm reading correctly, came through with a unanimous recommendation from P&Z?
Yes, they did.
Great. Any commission discussion?
No. Happy to move it.
Okay, sure.
Move to approve. Can I do all three at one time?
I think you can. We'll just do one at a time.
Okay, I move to approve all three of the changes. We have three here, just two.
Yes, there's three separate motions.
You can do them all in a row as long as you get a second to each.
Yes.
Okay. I would move to annex 1802 Stonehurst Road.
Second?
I'll second.
I would move to amend the comprehensive plan future land use map to establish single family future land use designation.
I'll second that one too.
On a roll.
I would move to amend the official zoning map to establish single family R1AA district zoning.
Great. I'll second that one.
Wonderful.
Makes sense.
You are on the record.
Do you have any questions for staff or any discussion from the commission? No.
No, sir.
Any public comments on this? No. Seeing none. Michelle, will you read the roll? Michelle. Jeez, I'm sorry, Cindy. It's just I got closer and threw off my vision.
It's okay. Commissioner Spiegel?
Yes.
Excuse me. Commissioner Sprinkle?
Yes.
Commissioner Cooper?
Yes.
Commissioner McMacken?
Yes.
Mayor Lear?
Yes.
You did.
On the second, the ordinance, the comprehensive plan.
Commissioner Spiegel?
Yes.
Commissioner Sprinkle?
Yes.
Commissioner Cooper?
Yes.
Commissioner McMacken?
Yes.
Mayor Lear?
Yes. And the third, the amending the official zoning map.
Commissioner Spiegel?
Yes.
Commissioner Sprinkle?
Yes.
Commissioner Cooper?
Yes.
Commissioner McMacken?
Yes.
Yes, thank you.
Three for three.
Where are we going on this next one? Larry?
Yes.
Reading this ordinance as well?
And there is just the single one. Right. This is ordinance, and there's a Scrivener's error on this. It's for signature by Mayor Ken Bradley, so for the record.
That was fixed, was it not?
Oh, you did fix that? Okay, I'm just looking at one in my book. Thank you. Thank you. An ordinance to the City of Winter Park, ordinance number 2990-15, annexing a portion of the right-of-way of Howell Branch Road, generally between 1620 Howell Branch Road and the city limits, more particularly described herein, providing for the amendment of the City of Winter Park's Charter, Article 1, Section 1.02, corporate boundaries, to provide for the incorporation of real property described herein, providing for the filing of the revised charter with the Department of State, providing for repeal of prior inconsistent ordinances and resolutions, providing for severability, and providing for an effective date.
Okay, folks, this is the second reading. Does anybody have any questions for staff or for...
I'd like to move it.
Great. I have Mr. Sprinkle.
I'll second that.
Mr. McMackin. Great. Any questions from the audience? Anyone? 70 residents? No. Great. Well, let's call the roll. Cindy, please, on the ordinance.
Commissioner Seidel?
Yes.
Commissioner Sprinkle?
Yes.
Commissioner Cooper?
Yes.
Commissioner McMackin?
Yes.
Mayor
Bailey? Yes. Thank you. Let's move on to 12C, request of Morning.
And an ordinance of the City of Winter Park, Florida, vacating and abandoning an electric distribution easement located at 326 Hannibal Square, Winter Park, Florida, more particularly described here and providing for conflicts and an effective date.
Great. Jeff, do you have any questions from the desk?
Yeah. Just real quick, this is just your routine vacation of an easement. There's no Florida Power easement that has no facilities within it and no future need to our, not, that we can see.
Okay.
I'd questions? Like to move it.
Great. Mr. Sprinkle? Do you have a second?
Do it.
A second.
Mr. Seidel? Excellent. Any discussion from the commission?
No, sir.
Public comment? No. Great. Ms. Cindy, would you call the roll, please?
Oh, you were on the roll, too. Doggone.
Yes.
Talking too much. Commissioner Sprinkle?
Yes.
Commissioner Cooper?
Yes.
Commissioner McMackin?
Yes.
Mayor Beard?
Yes. Okay, we have the adoption of the fee schedule next. It's a big one.
In the first three pages, I believe it is, you'll see the proposed changes to the fee schedule after the title sheet there. We'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Commission, any questions for staff?
I don't have a question. I'd just love to have them talk us through some of these changes, just what they are and why they're there.
That's fine. I'm happy to.
Whoever that might be.
I just have one quick question before he starts. What process did you use to create any changes? How did you do that?
We start out by, you know, asking each department to review the fees applicable to their department. And most of our fees are cost-based.
Right.
And so they look at it and determine, and that's why you see actually some of them going down versus up. You know, but it's more of that. Now, when you get into some of the use fees and parks and rec related to facilities, we look at our competition. So a lot of it's based on what our competition's doing and what our demand is for those spaces.
Do we have a benchmark that says we want every place to rent out so much percentage? Do we do anything like that? Or are we thinking about looking at that in the future?
I don't know, John, do you look at, do you have a percentage of how much you want a facility to be rented out?
As you said, some facilities are market driven by what other facilities are charging.
Right.
Some are just costs. We try to recover costs of operation. A lot of the athletic fields operate on that. The picnic shelters, we kind of evaluate. If one's not renting as much as it would, we will lower the price to accommodate it. But but they're all pretty well busy, and we're not having any problem renting the facilities. We do make adjustments when we see what might be a problem. Or we did remove three fees, special event fees. We removed from Craft Gardens because of the size and restriction on parking there. We didn't want to have somebody come in and put up huge tents and have a big, big event in that, because the neighborhood won't stand the parking. Dinky Dock is the same way. So we did remove those fees that had special event fees in it. So it's more housekeeping in our part of the program.
Just at some point, it would be helpful to know sort of, and maybe it's here, I just didn't see it, you know, how much are we really, are we 90% full? You say we're going to have any trouble renting, but I don't know what that percentage looks like. Yeah, down the road. It's not something to do now,
yeah,
but down the road.
It's a good discipline to put into it. I think it's worth taking a peek at.
Any particular facility you're interested in?
No, I don't. I just want to know, when we're renting things, what's come to me at times is, how do we come up with that figure? Do we come up with square footage? Do we come up with it? You've told me that. But then the other thing you've said is, well, and some are in more demand than others. Well, does that mean that we rent that the Winter Park Country Club at 90% a year? I just think it would be helpful down the road sometime to have that data.
Okay. So we understand.
Yeah,
we've got that.
What's popular? I know you do. I just haven't seen it. I just like to overlay it.
Okay.
Excuse me. I think it's smart. Go ahead.
John, that was going to be one of my questions to you, is about Azalea Gardens, because I do live right next there, so I'm very interested. When you remove a fee like that, does that equate to that is no longer allowed in that
Correct.
Park?
Oh, yes.
You thought it was free.
Well, yeah, because people are there all the time. I didn't think it was free.
Weddings are allowed in that park, but they're only supposed to have 20 guests. Is the limit.
And that has been getting out of hand.
Correct.
I appreciate that.
I've got it, Mr. Mayor. One of the items that's... I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I just
need to respond. One of the fees that I call it an impact fee that we have taken down to zero in the last couple of years has been the linkage fee.
Mm-hmm.
And I would very much like to revisit that from a standpoint of expanding the eligibility for that and starting to include workforce housing within that. I think we had affordable housing before. And I don't know whether Rand, I for Commissioner Seidel's point, I wouldn't mind if Randy or somebody or whoever might be able to address that, because I think we'd have to have an ordinance in order to bring in workforce housing as part of that.
Commissioner, I am in 100% agreement with you. I'd like to see a workforce housing program put into place. I know I spoke to Mr. Briggs over the past year about it, and we believe, or Jeff's interpretation was, when the linkage fee was created, it was, while affordable housing was used, it was also set up to accommodate workforce housing. But I'm not sure we ever really confirmed that was something.
And that's needed. And I don't know that either. So I guess my first question is an ordinance, is a change of ordinance required to include workforce housing?
And I think one of the questions to that, Commissioner, was also, then if we do change the ordinance, if we don't go as it was assumed that it could incorporate already, if we do change it, then does that mean that the money's currently set aside and that in there cannot be used for work?
Yeah, I think there's some clarifications. I just wanted to bring this up and say, hey, there's I would like this to be reconsidered.
I would like it as well.
And so
I would like it to be reconsidered for workforce housing, because I do think that we have done some work. And we have done some research in the affordable housing aspect of it.
We're getting there, and I look at that workforce end of the deal, and I say we're really we haven't scratched the surface on that. And that is something I know it's an action that is not on the agenda and may take some other research, but I'd certainly like, if an ordinance is required or something, I'd like that question.
Well, you have a nod here. If we're looking for kind of a workforce housing, the outlines of a workforce housing plan, is that fair, Commissioner?
That'd be fair, yes.
Okay, you have a nod here. If we have another one to nod in.
I just don't want to reinstate a fee right now.
I don't either.
Okay.
I didn't. What I'm saying is, what do we, because this is the, if we do create something, it would be under this.
That's why we never removed the line item.
Left it open.
For zero.
And that's why I'm bringing it up under the fee schedule and not as a separate item. So I would like to do, in my perfect world, is we would act on the rest of the fees this evening and have staff come back with a direction to go forward on a affordable or workforce housing aspect of that, yes.
And I'm fine with that, and Randy, correct me if I'm wrong, but we can assign the fee at any time during the year, we don't have to wait till the schedule.
Yeah, so that's, again, this was the time we brought it up, I guess it was convenient time to bring it up, and I don't know if Commissioner would like, or you can certainly, so I would, if we...
If you want to.
We have 3 minutes.
Mr. Mayor, is that something that would be a amendment to a motion to approve?
I don't think we need to, I think staff's heard direction.
Or is that fair enough to go the other way? Then I'm fine with that.
Okay, great. Thank you, Commissioner Cooper.
And as you go forward to look at this, would you bring back your research also, I think some of that research on the housing, about what is available in workforce as well as affordable within the city?
Okay, we had Wes, we called Wes up to...
To tell us about this. We probably already hit the ones we were most curious about, haven't we?
Is there anything that's jumping out?
Just the new, no, that was honestly, I was interested in the park, but any new fees, if you could just address those, I appreciate it.
Well, one thing I would mention is something that our building department is doing that'll be a great service to the builders in the community, is that we are partnering with a vendor to file notice of commencement and deed covenants with Orange County, so they can take care of that where they're here, and they avoid a trip to downtown Orlando to file the things with the county. And
having just done that, I got to say thank you very much. I had to go down to Orange County and get my notice of commencement for my driveway.
Yes, so it was, me too.
Otherwise, it's nothing particularly eye-catching, I don't think. Utility service fees or the regular tweaks they do based on cost. Each 6 months, they usually have some minor tweaks up or down a little bit that don't change revenues very significantly based on their cost. And then parks, John mentioned some of the things that they're doing. They have some changes and some clarifications that they've done for example, the cost to stripe fields. They set aside a different rate for field B because its size is much different than the other fields, so they...
Can we talk about the lift stations, Wes? Why we're doing the lift stations, the new $50 and $40 fees for private lift stations. Are those lift stations like are in individuals' homes or are those businesses? What are we talking about here?
They're probably going to have to help us out with that.
Yeah, I'm just trying to understand why we're doing that. Private lift station, if it's a fee we've never had before, what it is and why, what the cost is associated with that. Did this come from that ordinance that we just passed where now you have to go inspect them or something?
Yes, it does. Bottom line is there are literally probably 200 of those private lift stations scattered throughout our system, some in the county, some in the city, and they're privately owned, but they contribute flow to our system. We really don't have any way of regulating whether they're maintained properly. We frequently get calls about problems at that lift station. Maybe people think they're a city lift station. We respond to it. What this allows us to do, and we're charging a fee for a sign to be made to post there to show who owns it, who's responsible for maintaining it, and we can then log it so that when we get calls about them, we can direct the call to the correct person to come and fix the problem.
Aren't they under the ground? Are you going to put a sign in people's yard?
No, there's a control panel above ground that has usually a little warning light on it, and you know, it's for the power to come there, and there's some above ground electrical mechanism.
So these are new fees for lots of people. I mean, is this when you renovate your house or when you...
No, that's correct. It is a new fee. But it's not an every day, it's not an every year. I mean, there's a one-time fee for the sign that they don't have to do that all over again every year. So it's not a recurring fee for everything. Our annual check of it will be a small fee.
So this takes place when? This fee is imposed on them when?
Whenever they're scheduled for their annual review. It's not going to be, we have one person that's going to be responsible for doing that, so we're going to schedule them throughout the year.
Yeah, they're already connected to our system, right?
Yes, they're all connected, they're underground, they're being charged.
It's still an inspection fee. Hate to assign new fees, but you do have staff going out.
Those are pretty steep. Because you said there's also an inspection, there's a fee for you to inspect it?
They're both there. They're both there. So the $50 a one-time fee, the $40 is an annual fee. Is it $50 a fee, the $40 the first time? Or is it just the two signs?
You know, that's a good question. I would say that you probably could do that, certainly. It's not clear. We could do that.
I think the first time, I think you're getting consensus from the commission.
How many of these are there?
There are approximately 200 of them throughout our system.
And how did that happen? Because they were privately owned lift stations, and so are we trying to discourage people? We don't do that anymore?
Oh, no.
You have to have it.
No, what it amounts to is if you are connected to our system but you can't get to it by gravity, then you have to pump to it. But if it's a station that's serving an individual home or an individual business...
You mean like the water I take out of the lake?
No, that's for irrigation. This is for sanitary sewer.
Okay, that's what I thought. Okay.
If your house, for example, the slopes down to your house and you're having to pump up to the sewer line, you can't gravity sewer.
Right, I understand.
So you have your own lift station. Yeah, and there may be city lift stations for your neighborhood, for example.
There are city lift stations, okay.
But, and then, so...
I mean, I just didn't know if that was a choice that people had or not, because it seems like if you don't have a choice, it's sort of hard for us to go charging people for this. That's my problem with it right now. I'm looking at it with, okay?
Dave, do you know how many of these are outside the city limits?
The vast majority are outside the city limits. Because that's...
David, I'll ask one question. Do we currently inspect these on an annual basis?
No, we don't.
Don't even know where they are.
No, you know where they are. The problem is that
we ought to be inspecting them.
We regularly have to respond to problems with these private stations because we're the people that they think are responsible for it.
I mean, they inspect our water.
This allows us to track them to make sure that they have somebody on staff who's responsible for keeping it done.
Who else would be doing this?
You have to pay a private company, and you have to pay a private company. The city still won't be taking care of it.
That's correct.
Are there any DEP requirements for inspections?
When they're installed only.
I bet people don't even know they have this.
I bet they do.
You bet they do?
Oh, yeah. If you've got a private one.
It's just feeling kind of murky right now.
Well, I don't know why.
If the emergency
that are causing the issue, do you give them the option of paying these fees and having the inspections and then have an emergency fee of like $3,000 because you have to go out there and fix it and deal with it?
We don't go out and fix it. If we go out, what we have to do is respond to it, go out there, realize that it's a private station, then we have to try to get in touch with whoever is responsible for it, which is usually the property owner, and then they have to call somebody else to come out and do it. Frankly, this is pretty good preventative medicine for people to have this in place so that they have someone on staff ready to go and they can.
Commissioner Seidel's point though, do we inspect if there is a breakdown, are we notified of the breakdown? And if we're not and if we are notified of it, then do we inspect after the breakdown after it's fixed by a private contractor?
Not necessarily. If there was something that broke down on private property and they were aware of it before we were told about it, they would fix it and life goes on.
Okay. Listen, I think something that's contributing to our system from private residents, I think we need some kind of say if that's a. While I don't like to impose new fees, I think this is reasonable for an annual inspection of.
And we roll the sign in with the.
Roll the sign in with the first inspection.
I can put the sign up. I can tell you if you brought one to my house, unless you put it in there. Here's my big question. Do you have a choice? Okay. Does the homeowner have a choice?